Hello, gang. There's the music. It must be Wednesday morning.
Nice.
Get her a little. Oh, nice.
All the way to England.
Excellent. Excellent. Ah. How is everybody in the chat this morning? A lot of action going on already with the weather reports, which, you know what? I love that. I love hearing what other people are enduring. There's something with being Canadian, which really makes us like either proud or whiny or both about weather. So, you know, it's a point of cultural pride with us. So
you have an appreciation of other people's pain.
Yeah, we're very empathetic. Because even though we don't ever get I shouldn't say we don't. We did last week in some spots in Canada. No, even though we don't hit 115s or 120s or whatever, we can imagine that very easily in a sense that, you know, for us getting to 100 is extremely hot. And so we can endure, or we can empathize very well because of that. So, my goodness, where's Brent? Oh, he's on vacation this week, guys. And in Brent's chair, no, not in Brent's chair, in his own chair, but taking up Brent's video square this week is my fellow Domino colleague, Dr. Paul Schneider. Paul, this is your first time joining us, so introduce yourself to the folks.
Hey, thanks for having me. Well, I have joined once or twice in the audience, but not in the chair. Yeah, so I just a little bit quickly about myself. I come back into instructional design. Actually walked into it during my doctorate degree when I was studying counseling psychology and in the education department. And there's all these smart education folks out there that I started hanging out with, and this weird thing called the web that was starting to emerge. And well, as they say, the rest ended up being history. So glad to be here today, and really excited to hear more about accessibility. That's been something a little bit of one of my passions that I love to hear about. And I had the pleasure of meeting Susie last year and learning a bit more about her venture and really launching a much needed book here.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of which, joining us as well this week is Susie Miller, who is the author of, and you're going to hold the book up and you're going to tell us the title.
It's just Designing Accessible Learning Content.
Brilliant. And show us the side of that book, because I've heard it. Yeah, there we go. It's substantial. It's not just a PDF, folks. Oh, and look, Paul's got a copy too. Yeah. Susie, introduce yourself to our folks, a little bit of your background, etc.
Yeah, so I've been an instructional designer. Oh, I've got a bit of echo on my headphones here. Anything I can do to stop that?
I'm not certain, because I'm not hearing it. Paul, you're hearing
it? We're not hearing it. It's just going to be annoying for you.
Okay. I'll do my best. Okay, so I've been instructional designer for about 10 years, and I started,
Being an instructional designer means you deal with technical problems.
Yeah, that sounds a bit better. Okay. So I have been an instructional designer. I really can't do. I'm so sorry.
No worries.
Can I take the headphones out?
Well, let's give that a try. The echo may become something for all of us, but yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Susie, I've just temporarily muted your microphone there just to get that.
Okay, try again.
Do you hear us okay now?
I can hear you okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And
you sound great.
Yeah,
I sound great. Good.
You've been great from our side. Okay, you've been great from our side the whole time. So, although it's those,
it's like
going to
be in your own thoughts.
That's right. Very good.
So yes. So sorry, catastrophic technical problems today. Yes. So I have been an instructional line designer for about 10 years, and I started off in the public sector, and I have also done a lot of training in the past, and I moved into instructional design basically because that was the way the department was going. And when I started in my instructional design, I was always really interested in accessibility. And so that's why I ended up writing up the book.
Hmm. Awesome. And how's the echo for you now? Is it
still bad?
Yeah, yeah. Well, as Jennifer says in the chat, you do sound great twice.
The trouble is I can't concentrate what I'm saying.
I hear you, but not the echo. I definitely feel for you. What if you maybe put the headphones not right over your ears?
Okay.
Just, you know, a little bit less of hearing yourself, maybe, or just around your neck, maybe, or something. I don't know. I mean, you'll still hear an echo, but maybe you'll hear less of it, and it'll be less of an intrusion, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, that's
as long as you can still hear us enough to hear what we're saying. So
fantastic. Yeah. That's much better.
Yeah. You still sound great.
Yeah.
Please do.
Awesome. Cool. I was thinking about. We've done lots of stuff around accessibility. It's been a topic that Paul's been focused on, here at Domino for a while. But it's always been very meaningful and important to us. And one of the neat things, I'm using the word neat, but when we were first doing this thing, and Paul and I, we've been doing this for a long time. The only time that accessibility came up really was when we were talking to a government organization. And it felt like, a decade ago or so that the rest of the world, it wasn't something that was a focus in conversations. But the last 4 or 5 years, it really has become much more important to so many more organizations. And it sort of feels like people are finally starting to, get it, that it's important, and that it's a critical thing, to provide. Let's maybe talk a little bit about why it is so important to be able to make sure that, say content and other things are accessible.
So for me, I think the idea that the whole of what we're involved in and what we're doing is trying to make learners engaged. And it just seems inconceivable really to me that we're doing that and not making sure that all of our audience is engaged. So although there's lots of different, ideas about the statistics involved, I think it's fairly safe to say between about 12 and 26% of the population have a disability. So for me, it just doesn't make sense to be creating learning that isn't accessible for everyone, because automatically from the beginning, we're just, excluding people. And, there is no reason to do that. So I think for me, that's sort of the starting point of what we need to be aware of when we're talking about accessibility.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about as ahead of the our session today even, and what we even think of as a disability isn't we might have a couple of things in mind. We picture the wheelchair symbol, for instance, or we feel we see, but there are so many of us who have something. I mean, I have a need for these things now. I've reached the age where I
so
can't,
many people do.
I wouldn't consider myself in a big sense, having a disability, but it is a thing that I have to be aware of. And so reading things on a screen, etc., is always a thing. I got to either have the reading glasses or I got to be able to bump the fonts way, way bigger. I have a small knee problem, which I'm a relatively, healthy person, but sometimes I look at something and go, yeah, my knee's not going to be happy if I'm going to go up that incline, for example. So it's not just about, say, the most obvious I don't know what the term is, the better term maybe than more obvious, but it runs through so many lives that we don't really think about. We think about those, the parking stickers and those sorts of things, per se.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, too, there's so many what they call hidden disabilities. We don't see as often, but even that, just the things that you do, certain things you may do, you just don't run across people. Just like, if you live in certain areas, you don't run across certain cultures, and hang out. So you used to think, oh, there isn't, you hear that number and it's like, wow, that can't be true because I don't know anybody that has that. And the reality is, I think sometimes there are several people that you do know. You just didn't even know that they might have a challenge with a particular way things are presented or particular types of situations.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same in my case, not realizing, for example, that I was dyslexic until I was quite a lot older. There's a lot of people, I think, possibly, you know, our generation who, you know, aren't even aware necessarily that they have what I call, you know, a neurodiversity that would make it, you know, some certain types of learning more difficult for them. And for me, I have to say, discovering later on that you know, that is the way my brain works was just a revelation for me, thinking I've always thought, well, you know, what is it? Why is it that I can't understand that and everybody else can? So I think that there's that idea. And also, I think, as well as when we're talking about disability impairment, we can also be thinking about temporary and situational impairments as well. So not necessarily a disability, but, you know, the things that we can do to our learning to help people who have a disability actually help all of our learners. So, you know, it's very clear, things like captions and transcripts, etc., really help people depending on what situation they're in, and also, you know, how they prefer to learn as well. So for me, it's just it's a no-brainer, really. It's a real win-win to make things accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking of the I'm going to call it a cartoon, but the because I've only seen it done as a visual illustration, but the you know, you could build the stairs and then add a ramp on, or you could simply build a ramp to the front of the building and everybody mm-hmm. can take advantage of it, and there's not a separation of those and solving multitude of problems with one, you know, one simpler solution. One of the other things I think about, you were mentioning how people prefer, a lot of the things that we can do to help people have content be more accessible are also just practical things for the real world. An awful lot of folks just watch, you know, TV shows now with the subtitles on. There's lots going on in the room. We've got probably got a device in your hand too, and the dog's chewing in the corner, and so I know a lot of people who even just take advantage of that just to be able to, follow, period, in a very distracted world. So it extends certainly beyond things that people would think of as improving accessibility for folks with specific disabilities. Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, it can happen to us anytime. So here's me with my hearing impairment.
Nick has pointed out in the chat, gosh, wouldn't it be great if Crowdcast had a captioning feature built in? Uh-huh. And I mean, some tools do. PowerPoint can run captioning, live in process, which is brilliant. Yeah. Just take a look at the chat here. So Kim's throwing in, I think one idea with accommodation is that you bake it into the learning environment without having to go outside. It's ubiquitous and a natural part of the learning experience. I mean, that's kind of the metaphor of the ramp versus stairs and a ramp. It's part of what everybody does, and therefore it's accessible to everybody, I guess, eh?
And Taryn is talking about that too, the universal access approach. I mean, I think back in the day when we didn't think about accessibility, or not enough of us were, it'd be like, oh, we need to allow for the audio not to play because they might have a noisy office, you know, yeah. Which, but in reality, adding all those different things in can have an impact. Or you talked about dyslexia and those, a lot of other cognitive disabilities. You don't even know that people have those issues or challenges, even if you've talked to them for a while. But then also there's all sorts of folks that have English as a second language, mm-hmm. or perhaps not the same education level. And those have a positive effect on everyone in that area too, which is a nice benefit. And again, when people are thinking about accessibility, they don't always think about those items.
Mm-hmm. So let's circle back, Susie, I guess back to the book itself. Tell us a little bit. You mentioned that you'd had an interest in accessibility. One of the things I'm always fascinated by is what prompted you to move from being interested in to actually the sheer level of effort in making a book?
So I think that the main thing for me was just I was waiting for somebody else to write this book. And nobody was. So I all the greats, I was thinking, well, soon they'll be writing this book. But it just came to the point where I thought, I must be one of thousands of people who are struggling with this. And I really felt that partly because our industry, I feel really, is full of people who genuinely do care about about making learning, appropriate so that everybody can get the best out of it. And I really felt that there was, all of the instructional designers that I was talking to had a similar attitude to me. They were saying, well, we should be making this accessible, but when we come to do it, it's simply so difficult. We're looking at standards which are they don't seem to be written for us, they're written for web developers, and whenever we try, it's just so difficult that people were giving up. And I was thinking, I did spend a long time myself trying to get to grips with the web content accessibility guidelines. And Paul, I think we had that discussion, didn't we, about just simply how difficult it was to try and apply them to learning and to understand them. And in the end, I thought, well, I've just spent so long doing this anyway, why not share this with people? And I think that one of the things that I found quite difficult when I started writing the book was just this idea that you kind of set yourself up as an expert. But that, you think, well, it's that kind of imposter syndrome. Who am I to be writing this book? But I suppose in the end, I just felt it's better for somebody to write it and to put it out there. And I'm sure that people will disagree with some of the things that I've written and some of the interpretations that I've made of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. But in the end, I just felt this is just so important that if I put it out there and people disagree with me, that's great in a way, because at least then it's a conversation. At least it's something that, we can have that discussion as an industry, and we can say, well, actually, no, our interpretation as an industry of this particular standard is that it means that's ultimately what I hope will happen from it. And as I say, it really isn't perfect. It's, I think if you work with Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, you find out quite soon that they, even you don't have to be an instructional designer. I think even web developers find that they are open to interpretation. So I think once I understood that actually they was having the same issues that I was, I just felt, well, as I say, it's just something that really needs to somebody to do. So yes, I just thought, well, I might as well do it because I've already done a lot of the work and nobody else was.
Yeah, I was, when you first connected, or we first connected, I was so pleased that you were having a focus on instructional design, because as I wrote about it and learned myself, there are some great courses out there. Even there's several pretty good books out there, some of the ones you knew too, you had read there, but again, they are a more general focus on accessibility and web design, which of course e-learning is a subset of that. And as you talk to e-learning professionals, and the tools have gotten a lot better, which is very awesome in terms of that. But at the end of the day, sometimes people think if, oh, I just turn on the button, right? Or I run the checker. And as you learn, it's kind of like, oh, I just push the cool graphics button and then all of a sudden I have a beautiful design. It's more than just checking the box in a lot of cases. It is design. I was curious as to some of the things that you looked to kind of add to the story or add to the information that were specifically in the instructional design and development world of e-learning that either helped make it more understandable as opposed to people coming from a web design development or the books that focus on that. Obviously, the core topics at the top level are the same, but how you break them down can be quite a bit different.
Definitely. So I think that the main thing for me was, I suppose, being an instructional designer myself, was that was always what was guiding me. It was what do I need? If I was starting from scratch, what would I need to have if I started? And that basically was what the book was. So I think the main thing for me was as I looked at as many different tools as I could, because I wanted there to be, you know, it's quite difficult I think quite often as an instructional designer, you tend to focus on one or two tools that you know very well. And what I wanted to do in the book is just really, you know, have a broad brush approach and have as many different tools as I could, even though, you know, they haven't gone into a lot of detail, because I think it shows that there are so many tools that are doing things, you know, but we talked, Paul, didn't we, that, you know, that tools are getting much better. Mm-hmm. But I think what I wanted to show was that there is actually really good practice out there. And if I could show how different tools were applying those principles, I think that was a huge starting point for me. And then I think another thing that I felt was really important with the book was that kind of background knowledge of understanding things like assistive technology. And I think, you know, and one of the reasons that I put the learner case studies in there was because I felt I hadn't really had a great deal of experience of learners actually struggling with the content that I created. So I really wanted there to be a focus on that people side of things, so that we even if you haven't had any experience of someone with a disability using your learning or trying to learn from your resource, then the idea that actually some of the things that you do can create barriers, and the types of things that can do to your learner was a real key thing for me. And as I say, coming back to that, one of the things that was really important was that assistive technology, because I don't think that it's possible really to understand, you know, to really understand why you're doing things unless you have a pretty good idea of the assistive technology that people will use. So for example, you know, to understand why you have to put the reading order in the right order, you don't really understand. You know, it's difficult to get sort of get your head around that unless you actually understand how a screen reader works. And then, you know, a screen magnifier, for example, what you would need to do to your learning for someone who's really looking at a very small portion of the screen at a time. So I think for me, those were the key things that I felt were really important. So it was a kind of background, and it was then being able to apply it to a whole range of tools. So not thinking, well, OK, I don't have the manual which shows me how to use my tool to make this accessible. The next best thing is to have something that shows me the principles, and then I can see how I can apply the principles or how maybe another tool is doing it. And then that, I think, for me is a real help, just to get that kind of, I suppose, the context of what you're doing before you start. Because I think that's the thing about, you know, I know we do focus a lot on the web content accessibility guidelines because, you know, they're quite often the legal compliance that we're aiming for. But, you know, even if you're not trying to meet every one of those requirements, I think it's just getting that understanding and the context before you start, not when you've kind of finished and then you're trying to shoehorn it in at the end. So it was kind of like that. Those were the key things, I think, that I wanted to include in the book.
Yeah, I think that and there are some things in the chat too talking about, is it, you know, a checklist or a continuum? And I think you've said that to me, and I found that too. It's really a continuum. A lot of times people are brand new. Can I just, like I said, turn on those options on and off? Or how come the tool doesn't have a step-by-step on how I make it accessible and turn it on after the fact? It's kind of like, I liken it to, if you're familiar with graphic design or you're familiar with instructional design, you don't just go ahead and create content or whatever and apply it after the fact. You need to be thinking about those things as you're developing and going through. And you can make something that's instructionally sound, or you can make it instructionally awesome. And, you know, both can be there, and both are a step above not doing anything. But it's not something that is quote unquote done. And of course, the standards obviously continue to evolve, as does the technology. And that's another challenge too, I found, is just like playing around with technology. And if it's a new technology, you know, part of it's struggling with the new technology. If you go to use accessibility technology, you've never used it before, part of your struggle is just learning that tool and then learning how it's done. Just seeing someone else use different technologies and having that experience combined can really see where people can go, and then how whatever you're doing can make an impact. And even something that you're like, oh, that's not that big a deal because you're so slow through it, but those other people are using the super speed, and then that thing really just slows them down and puts them dead in their tracks. It's like trying to stop a train, and you do. Those are some things that you just don't experience until, like you said, you try it out yourself and get a chance to work with people in that situation. Mm-hmm. And again, the situations do vary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole idea of thinking about this as part of your, you know, getting started, even as part of your instructional design phase, some of the earliest projects that where we came across having to, you know, make sure that there was something accessible, and the default was to just make a PDF of all the content and provide that, you know, so that somebody could take it, you know, in that format as an alternative. And boy, what a in hindsight, what a disappointing thing that was to do.
Well, think about if you were able-bodied and, or I like the TB, temporary able-bodied. We're all temporary able-bodied, which is true. And it's like, okay, that's the version you get. Are you satisfied with that version? And no. I mean, let's face it, there are good books out there. So they definitely can be learning resources, but take advantage of the technology.
And I think that's also one of the reasons that accessible e-learning has a bad name, because I think this idea that we have to, you know, that accessible learning cannot be interactive, it can't be engaging. I think that quite often stems from the fact that, you know, our mindset before was, okay, if it's accessible, we just produce the PDF. We don't have to worry about, you know, the learning experience. We literally just have to give a text version of that. And I think that's one of the areas where as an industry, I think we really need to look beyond.
I'll just check in, Paul. Or
freeze up. Yeah,
Susan, you seem to have been frozen up a bit on us here. We'll just give it a heartbeat, see if your video feed comes back for us.
I think one of the since we're experiencing a little technology, I think one of the things Susie's book was really great at, and also folks that are getting into it are experiencing, is that the technology, while fortunately has gotten a lot better, especially in the last couple of years, to support all sorts of ways of interacting with content, it's there is still a lot of variance. It reminds me, again, I'm dating myself, but it reminds me of the early web days, although they lasted for a painfully long time, where the browsers had all sorts of different interpretations, how things would work and different things played different ways. And in some cases, that's true with accessibility and some of the technologies there too. You know, you and so it's also good, you know, to know your audience and which tools that the tech team or whoever is supporting those, so you can make sure that those are the ones you test and work with. Hopefully in another few years, that will be a moot point too, just like finally browsers are almost in parity too, even though today that's still not 100% true. I don't think that'll ever leave us, which is both good and bad with that.
I'm just taking a second here, gang, to find Susie one more time and re-invite her back on screen. I'm probably scrolling way too fast through the list of folks.
And one of the things I loved about, you know, this book, and I haven't got through it all myself yet, but I just did get it recently while I was on vacation, of course. But as I said to Susie there, there aren't any books out there. I mean, I looked far and wide trying to find another book that actually spoke specifically to e-learning and the technologies. And even if it didn't speak to the tool, which I like, and Susie, maybe now that you're back with us there, stole some bandwidth from the rest of the house. That's the problem with everything. Everyone at home is stealing all the bandwidth. But
it's because I got my laptop, not my desktop. So absolute disaster. I'm so sorry. Unmitigated disaster is all I can
no
say.
No worries. You know, one of the things, and we started in our beginning of our conversation about empathy, but all of us having these temporary working conditions for the last year and change, and all the technical glitches that can happen, et cetera. I think the world recognizes the authenticity of our experiences.
That's very, very kind of you to say. Thank you.
Lots of patience around that. I won't mention the number of times I've had problems, et cetera. So anyway, very cool. Let me just say, Susan, there was a question about the book itself, and a couple of people have asked. So before we forget, if you've got a copy, say, I don't know, a link to it on the publisher's page or whatever, let's throw that in. Just to see, just to make sure that we've got that for folks who are asking at the current time. So.
And while I paste that in there, let me throw out a question to you. You can give some thought in the background. So one of the things I ran into in reading books and courses is they did give some good practical and, hey, here's how you might test something. Again, I was focused on web development there. Of course, that's part of your subtitle, A Practical Guide to Applying Best Practices. I was wondering if you could share some of the things that you tried to put into the book that really help people out in terms of the practical application of some of those different principles. And I'm thinking in from not only developing, but probably testing and validating, because sometimes you put something in there and you're like, did I do it right? I don't know.
So, yeah, I think one of the key things for me was wanting to put what I call a contextual framework to the whole of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So I kind of built part of the book around what I call the e-learning accessibility framework. And it just looks at it from the point of view of, you know, if you're coming at this as an instructional designer, what do you need to know at certain stages of the project? Bear in mind that I know everybody sort of, you know, they do things differently, they have different tools, but a kind of a core framework that you can use. So, and I felt that was really, really important to really start breaking it down so that you could start applying it. So it just starts, for example, with what you need to do when you're setting up the project, what things do you need to bear in mind, and also it then breaks it down into sort of contextual steps. So what would you need to do, for example, everything that you need to know when you are adding images, everything you need to know if you're putting text in there, for example, what do you need to know when you're looking at quizzes and assessments, and then sort of moving on to sort of your interactivity. So I think that was the key thing for me, was just trying to make it a framework that you could apply step by step. And also by doing that, it also allows you to then, it breaks it down and it allows you to dive in where you need to. So even if you know, you suddenly become, are looking at
it. Liz has been able to find a link to toss into the chat there for the URL, etc., for the book, which is brilliant. And Susie, your video was coming in and out again there as well. David's asking in the chat if you cover in the book, and it's, I think it's partly what Paul was also speaking to as well, you know, tech recommendations for, you know, QA testing, things like browsers or different screen readers that we should be aware of, those sorts of things. Let's just see.
I don't think it. She didn't like that question. That's how I feel when I get a hard question. Sometimes I just want to disconnect.
Can you ask me that question again, please?
For sure. Yeah. So David in the question panel is asking if in the book you're also covering tech, you know, recommendations for QA testing. He's suggesting, for instance, JAWS or recommended browsers, those sorts of things.
Yeah, so what I did in the book was to try and sort of come away a little bit from this idea that accessibility is something that only accessibility experts can do. So I I sort of broke it down into, when you're doing your testing, things that you can do easily on your own. So, for example, you know, even without any assistive technology, for example, you can test, for example, that you can, with a browser, you can test that you can zoom into your text to 200%, for example. You can use a keyboard to make sure everything's keyboard accessible. Then you get the next step, which is sort of things that you can do with some, you know, with kind of tools which are easy for everyone to use, for example, like contrast checkers and changing things to grayscale, for example, to make sure that you're not making all of your, any of your instructions dependent on color alone, things like that. And then the next stage, I kind of call it testing with tools or with more, you know, usually assistive technology. And that is where your screen reader kind of testing comes in. So although the screen reader testing is a really interesting one, because although you can test basic things with a screen reader, I found certainly in the last year working with a screen reader tester who uses JAWS daily, that's a different experience from what we tend to do as very basic testing. And the interesting thing for me is that actually sometimes, as I say, you could do things like testing your alt text, testing things like your reading order is correct, things like that. But when you see a screen reader user who's an experienced screen reader user, they will sometimes look at your content and things that you might have been agonizing over for hours thinking, I don't know why this is working like this. They will say, well, that's just an anomaly of the screen reader. So it's actually working. You know, when you get to that level of working with assistive technology, if you can, I think that's where it's hugely beneficial to work with someone who has got a lived experience of a disability and is an experienced user. And then you've got yet another layer, which is your sort of real coding. And if you're going into that, so some of the web content accessibility guidelines are they are based around coding. So that again is where accessibility experts are very useful, because, you know, most of us don't know, you know, enough about accessibility coding to know whether something is compliant or not. But you can also obviously go to the tool, and hopefully the tool will give you, a conformance report or a VPAT, voluntary product accessibility test, which will tell you that information. If it doesn't, that's usually where I would say, well, you know, an accessibility tester who knows about the coding is kind of essential. But there's certainly a huge amount that you can do when it comes to testing. And when it comes to specific tools, for example, you said that the screen readers, I think, you know, that the most popular ones are, you know, the third party ones tend to be JAWS and NVDA in particular, because NVDA is open source and free. And then you also have the inbuilt ones, for example, VoiceOver, for example. So, yeah, I think there's certainly a huge amount that you can do when you can test yourself. But, you know, it does get to the point where I think you working with accessibility experts is certainly very valuable. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about the kind of process, I agree with you, Paul. It's that in my framework, it's a circular framework. So it's just reminding you that, you know, once you've created that, it's when it comes to testing, when it comes to, you know, updating, it needs to go through the circle again, really, that you're double checking that everything is still compliant or is still accessible for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like your comment about the testing and the levels. It's something that is kind of evolved from my thinking too, is that there are a lot of, no pun intended, accessible tools out there that are more accessible to everyone every day, that you can kind of do that first level of testing and make a really big impact without having to, oh, I need to get into using JAWS. And not that that's a bad thing there, but you can really go ahead and test some of those different items. One of the other things I saw in the chat, and I think is unique about your book, so I wanted to just comment on it, is that I think in your book, you did try to, of course, tools are evolving all the time, but you did try to speak to some different tools like Storyline, Captivate, Domino, specifically by those, because none of the books and none of the guides talk about any of that. Want to share a little bit?
Yeah, so I think for me, that was, again, it was difficult not to try. And I suppose that was one of the stumbling blocks at the beginning, thinking I need to write something that helps everybody with their particular tool. And it just, you know, that just isn't possible. And as you were saying, it's also the tools are being updated all the time, you know, so it's impossible to write the manual of how to actually use your tool to make something accessible. So I think my approach really was to just to look at that best practice. So if any tools were achieving some of the standards, then to put that into the instructions. But also there's a section at the beginning of the book where I focus on the best practice, and obviously your tool is one of those where you're just looking at some of the really good things that tools are doing, and hopefully by sharing that, it's giving other people an opportunity that you know, other tool providers to see what's good practice and what mm-hmm. actually that they can do as well. So, you know, one of the things I love about your tool is the way that accessibility is just part of the process, and it isn't something that feels like a chore or something that's bolted on at the end. It just is part of the workflow. So that's, you know, great. And also things like accessibility checkers that make your life easier, you know, really good instructions on how to use the tool. So, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that there are these guidelines which are around called ATAG to help authoring tool providers to make their tool accessible. And so one of the things that they say is that the authoring tool provider should A, make the authoring tool itself accessible, that they should make it easier for people to make, so possible for people to make the output accessible, but also that they should give guidance. So if a tool can give you guidance on how to do that, then I think that's a fantastic best practice that hopefully is moving forward. And if you can bury that, or you can, you know, if that's in the actual workflow, so you're not having to go and look at the book or not having to go and look somewhere else, that is the ideal situation. So that there's plenty of things. It isn't perfect, but it's you know, the sort of the best that you can do, that best that I could do anyway, of trying to make sure that we were looking at various different tools and not excluding you know, anybody who was using a particular tool.
Mm-hmm. It is, from one perspective, it's a very technical topic, especially when we're thinking about web stuff. And so many of us in our roles, we might know a tool, but we don't know, you know, the web world, for instance, at that level of depth. So it can be a very daunting thing to start thinking about. And we may even struggle just with the culture of the organization around us, which may or may not put a priority, you know, on these sorts of things. As I mentioned, you know, we've seen a transition where we do find more and more non-governmental companies, you know, are making this a focal point, which is a brilliant thing. But for many people, it's still I guess we have to do this or et cetera. So there's the technical knowledge, the you know, that level of our own competency, but there's also the cultural change that needs to take place as well within trying to explain to your boss why we're going to add X amount of time to the development of something because we need to do some new things, et cetera. Did you have any strategies within the book for helping people be able to address that within their own organization?
And kind of adding to that is, you know, people talked about adding it after the fact and then having it as part of your workflow. And then, of course, people are to the point of, hey, this is going to add in so much more time and effort. What's the reality? Of course, there's always a learning curve, anything new. But once you've learned it, the actual applying it, tell us a little bit more about that and that strategy, too.
So yeah, I think there's lots of things that you can do to make sure that accessibility isn't seen as something that's additional. And I think that for me is kind of the vision of where it would be great to become as an industry, where accessibility just becomes the default. You know, we don't even think about it. And I did see something recently on social media, which is kind of a light bulb moment for me, was that it said something like, accessibility doesn't take more time. You were just cutting corners before the work wasn't complete. And I thought, for me, that really summed it up, you know, and that's where I think that the change of the mindset, I know that's quite radical looking at it, but I think in an ideal world, that's where we need to be. Accessibility is just how it should be, but there are things that you can do to embed it in the, you know, to make it easier in the organization, things like, making sure it's at the beginning of a project that accessibility is considered, that it's not shoehorned in at the end, because then obviously it really does, you know, the cost and the time really do increase considerably. And I think, you know, you can have things, yeah, the key that you were talking about there was like explaining it to your manager, getting leadership on board, I think is absolutely crucial, so that, you know, that everybody has a different mindset. And it's not like, when you're, certainly the situation that I've been in the past is that, you know, managers quite often think, well, make something accessible, off you go and do that, you know, it won't take very long. It's kind of making sure that tick the box. So it's making sure that you know, that all levels are aware. But it's things like also, you know, having things like people champions who are across the organization, etc., so that it's that kind of idea of, yeah, I agree with you, it is a cultural change. And then that makes our jobs you know, as instructional designers, so much easier, if it's, you know, if the whole organization is behind accessibility, and you're not the only person just saying, oh, actually, this is, we need to put captions on this, and we need to be doing this. So yeah, I think it's we have got a way to go, but I think this we're at a great point now. And I think I certainly see that there's traction and people are becoming more aware. So I think if we can have the key thing then is getting the leadership of our industry involved, I think, and getting them on board, I think that would be, you know, hugely significant.
For sure. And I think the fact that we now have a book that we can show as an outside level of authority and influence, it sounds like a small thing, but until some of these things, you know, reach certain stages, it becomes harder. It remains hard to sometimes convince people up the chain, etc. Susie, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to play the music.
Thank you.
We'll get ourselves rolled out, but make sure you toss in your contact info here send ourselves along.
I'd just like to apologize again for my technical issues. No,
it's all good. It's all good. Everything's
good. You traveled all the way across the pond to connect, so.
Normally with no problem.
And thank you. Just before I forget, I've got a little bit of housekeeping here too. For those of you who haven't yet, make sure you guys connect with us in the LinkedIn group. We have a LinkedIn group where we follow up on a lot of these topics. Join us there to keep the conversation going on this front.
Ask more questions. Yeah.
Gang, thanks so much to everybody for joining us. The chat, as always, has been fabulous, and the questions were great too. We have such a great gang of folks who join us every week here. And we hope you join us again next week, guys. Have a great time. And in the meantime, keep dancing until next Wednesday.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Big finish. Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of your week, and we'll catch you guys next time.